Great scientists, as we know, make great discoveries. That's what makes them great scientists. And almost with unerring instinct, they can cut through the chaff to find the wheat. That is a common view, but indeed, it is a very mistaken view. As Mario Livio, author of the new book, Brilliant Blunders, is eager to inform us. The subtitle of Brilliant Blunders, From Darwin to Einstein, Colossal Mistakes by Great Scientists That Changed Our Understanding of Life and the Universe. What's the most colossal mistake in this book, would you say?
I think all of them are really pretty colossal. I would say, you know, maybe the steady state is a colossal mistake. The theory that Fred Hoyle heads, that the universe was always the same and will always stay the same, may have been the most colossal mistake.
In fact, he was rejecting the Big Bang cosmology. He's actually the author of the term Big Bang, and he did that as a derogation, making fun of the theory, though in fact, apparently, as far as we know, that's the way our universe began.
That's right. It was in a radio program. And, you know, it was not so much a derogatory remark. It was, he wanted more to give his listeners a mental picture of what that theory was about. So he said, well, there are those who suggest that the whole universe was started in one Big Bang, you know, and so on. And that term caught.
The five scientists whose great errors are reviewed in this book, and the point made about all of them is that though they made great errors, those errors ultimately led to clarification of profoundly significant scientific issues and thus contributed to scientific advance. Those great scientists are Linus Pauling, Lord Kelvin, Darwin himself, Fred Hoyle, to whom we just referred, and Einstein. Let's stay with Hoyle for just a moment. It was a very attractive theory. I ran into it when I was an undergraduate. The notion was that the world has ever been what it presently is, the universe is. But to be sure, by then, there was evidence that the universe was expanding, so you had the problem of how you fill the universe with enough energy to sustain its expansion. And his answer was the spontaneous generation of matter.
That's right. So basically, he already knew, because we knew since the late 1920s that the universe is expanding. Now, if the universe was supposed not to change, then that meant that, you know, if the universe is expanding, at least the density of matter would have gone down. You know, the universe would have been diluted.
Yeah.
So he added a term to his equations that, you know, sort of created matter spontaneously. Now, you must realize it created it at a very slow rate. I mean, it was, you know, like one atom per century per volume of the Empire State Building.
Yes.
It was not something you could immediately measure, but it was still creating matter out of nothing. And people were strongly objecting to that. They said, how come? How can you all of a sudden? What about conservation of energy and all that? And to that, actually, Fred Hoyle came with a very nice answer, which said, what do you mean? In the Big Bang, you suggest that everything appeared all at once. What I'm suggesting that it appeared slowly at a very slow rate.
That's a very compelling answer, I would say.
Yeah, it was a very nice answer. His theory was actually extraordinarily elegant.
Yes.
You know, think about this for a moment. You know, we have something that's called the cosmological principle. Which is that the universe is the same everywhere and in every direction. That everybody agrees on, and all the observations suggest that that's indeed the case. Well, Hoyle then said, wait a second, the same in every place and in every direction, how about also the same at all times? It was really a fantastic idea.
It does have great elegance, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Of course, that and all other cosmological hypotheses, they court and they avoid the central unanswerable question, which is nothing less than why there is anything rather than nothing.
That's right. And you know, people manage to get around that at some level by saying, you know, the total energy of our universe is in fact zero, because there is positive energy that comes from all the matter and radiation, but there is negative energy that is associated with the force of gravity, so that it adds up to zero. So there is nothing is violated by the universe appearing out of true nothing. But of course, there is still the question, why did it appear out of true nothing, out of complete nothing? And that is where, you know, everybody starts having problems with that and saying, well, you know, if it doesn't violate anything, then of course it can happen. We know that in quantum mechanics, things that can happen indeed happen with a certain probability, and therefore this is how our universe came into being.
I've often pressed that very question upon colleagues at the University of Chicago, that is, colleagues who are, unlike me, a mere psychologist, but who are astrophysicists and cosmologists. And their standard answer is, how does this come out of nothing? Is, well, but nothing is unstable, as a vacuum is unstable. Nature does not abhor nothing, and thus we must have something, which is not an answer at all. It's a bit of a philosophical trick, but that's about all one can do with it.
Right. I mean, look, the main point, I mean, that, you know, scientists make is that there is no violation of anything by the universe appearing out of nothing, in the sense that it has zero energy. It has no energy. Now, why does it actually appear? So again, you know, we appeal to the fact that quantum processes are probabilistic, and there is a probability for anything that is allowed to actually happen, and therefore a universe can appear.
Now, the basic argument of your very fascinating account in the new book, Brilliant Blunders, is that those great brilliant blunders advance science just as do the non-blundering correct apprehensions of reality. How did Hoyle's great mistake move astrophysics forward towards truth?
Well, you see, for about 15 years, Hoyle's theory of a steady-state universe was a serious contender to the Big Bang theory. And the fact that that theory existed actually prompted many, many observations of people who actually tried to distinguish between the two theories. And eventually, that led to many observations that showed that the universe in the past was indeed different from the universe at the present, and this is, you know, what strengthened the Big Bang scenario. So Hoyle's theory helped as a catalyst, you know, to actually thinking about observations that can be done in order to distinguish between the two theories, which was not possible when he actually suggested the theory. There was nothing when he suggested the steady state theory to say that his theory was wrong. And it was only, it took time, a couple of decades, before observations started to show that indeed the universe was different in the past.
I suppose it is the measure of the quality of the scientist, or his honesty, or his vigor, or what have you, to ask how does he take, how does he respond to the full disconfirmation of his famous guess. In this case, Hoyle finally had to yield and say, yes, I am wrong, I was wrong. Did he do it with grace, or was it difficult?
No, in his case, it was very difficult. He actually was at some level in denial till the last day of his life. He was an extraordinarily smart person, and kept coming up with all kinds of ways to explain away the evidence from the Big Bang in other ways, and to still keep some version of the steady state universe. He tackled other problems, you know, like the appearance, emergence of life in the universe, and he thought that the universe that started from a Big Bang just did not have enough time. Mm-hmm. Who have life emerge and so on. So he had his reasons why he stuck to his ideas, but in his case, it was not graceful.
One of the other people who's treated in this book is Lord Kelvin. He can best be identified, I suppose, as the father of thermodynamics. Would that be right?
Certainly one of the fathers, I would say.
But what was at issue was the age of the Earth,
right?
Which we know to be, we know the age of the age of the universe is some 14 billion years. The age of the Earth
is about 4.5 billion.
Four and a half billion. His guess was something between 400,000 and a million.
Well, his guess was about, no, his guess was about 100 million.
Well, 100 million. Well, yeah. Then he was
his
close.
Guess was about 100 million.
He was closer to the truth, but still pretty far away from it.
Was very far away. He was almost a factor of 50 too short from the real age. You know, the universe is 4.5 billion. He was 100 million. But you see, there was something really fantastic about his estimate, because he was the first person who actually said, look, I can actually calculate an age for the Earth using the laws of physics. I mean, this was phenomenal.
What was the nature of the calculation? What did he...
So the nature was a bit like, you know, like in forensics, when they measure the temperature of a corpse and they can tell you the time of death.
Yes.
So basically that was his idea. He said the Earth was formed hot and molten, and it is, has been losing energy since then. So by actually determining how the temperature changes with depth as you go inside the Earth, I can tell you for how long the Earth has been cooling, or the age of the Earth.
So what was wrong with his methodology?
So there were two things that were wrong. I mean, the thing that really got him was the fact that he somehow didn't realize that heat could be transported inside the Earth, deep inside the Earth, more efficiently than just conduction, like, you know, like you put a skillet on the fire and you see the handle, you know, getting hot. Inside the Earth, it is more fluid-like, so you can get heat being transported by convection, like, you know, like when you put oil in a pot on the fire, and you know, the hot oil at the bottom rises to the top and the cold one goes down. So the fluid moves, and he didn't somehow take that into account. A second thing which he didn't take into account was the fact that radioactivity was not discovered when he did his first calculation. And the radioactive decay of radioactive elements actually provides heat. And he thought that the Earth was only losing heat, but the Earth is actually also gaining heat from this radioactive decay.
Now, Kelvin at this time was, I suppose, considered one of the scientific giants of European culture generally, wasn't he?
He was, I think, probably the most prominent physicist of his time. I mean, he was buried alongside Newton. I mean, that tells mm-hmm. you the kind of respect that he was getting.
And how did he adapt better to the counter-evidence, or was he also insistent that he was right?
Unfortunately, he was also rather insistent. I mean, he admitted on several occasions that he might have been wrong on a few things, but overall he was quite stubborn in his views. He was another case of somebody who has been extraordinarily creative and a genius youth, has become somewhat cranky and stubborn at old age.
Is it your argument that error is essential to the progress of science?
Yes, it absolutely is essential. Because, you see, the way that things work is that if you don't discover the error, I mean, it's not just that the error, but, you know, realizing that something is an error is absolutely essential. Science does not progress in a straight line, you know, from A to B. It progresses in some sort of a zigzag path where you have many, many false starts, you hit lots of blind alleys and so on, but you need to hit those blind alleys to know you're not going in the right direction. Now, I'll give you a very simple example. Aristotle, the great Aristotle, thought that women have a different number of teeth than men.
Oh, really?
Yes. Now, Aristotle was married, and he's never occurred to him to actually count the teeth in his wife's mouth. Had he done that, he would have realized that this is wrong, you know, and so on. Now, in Aristotle's case, essentially everything he said about physics turned out to be wrong. But because his theories became part of the orthodoxy, and people were kind of not allowed to question Aristotle, it took, you know, thousands of years for people to realize that, you know, his theories were wrong.
He also made some significant mistakes in his biological knowledge.
Yes.
I believe it's Aristotle who says that the seat of intelligence, or of mentation generally, is more or less in the abdomen.
Yes. Now, look, I mean, Aristotle was a genius. There is no doubt about this. You know, he started entire disciplines, you know.
Oh, of course, yes.
Yeah, but he, for example, didn't know much mathematics and had very little appreciation from experimental physics, you know, and so on. So because his views became part of the orthodoxy, it was very difficult to change, you know, those theories. So the way science progresses is by finding what's wrong. I mean, science, you have a theory, and, you know, according to Karl Popper, the famous philosopher of science, you cannot show that the theory is correct. You can only show that it is wrong. So the theory is correct until proven wrong, basically.
And for a long time, we accepted the notion that the mark of a science is that it produces hypotheses which are, quote, falsifiable.
Exactly,
but,
right.
So, but there are some philosophers of science these days who argue that that's also a limited too flattering a view of the regularity of science. That
you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But still, you know, something being falsifiable, or, you know, if you want to use a somewhat different word, verifiable, is one of the hallmarks of the scientific method. And so what that means is that you need to be able to find those errors or those blunders.
It's worth noting that one of the, quote, sciences which he examined and which he found incapable of falsifiability was then a very popular general theory of the human mind and the human personality, namely psychoanalysis. He argued, and those beyond him, but using the Popperian view, demonstrated that there's nothing you can say in psychoanalysis that is falsifiable.
Right.
Which was a devastating kind of critique of the works of Sigmund
Freud.
You're
absolutely right, yes.
You know, of the many people who show up in your book, I met two of them. And they're both...
That's fantastic.
And they're in the same chapter. Linus Pauling... and James Watson. I met Pauling when I was a student, and he came and gave a lecture. I was at Ohio State University at the time, and I knew he was a famous man. I didn't understand the lecture, but he seemed quite pleasant and rather jocular and so on. Many years later, when I was doing a radio program in which we featured science a good deal, Watson came along. This is only about 3 or 4 years ago, I guess, when he did a memoir. He came twice, once for that and then later on for another book, but he got into trouble on that book promotion adventure because he went to London and spoke about the natural inferiority of certain human races, which instantly got him into trouble.
Of course, yes. I actually met Jim Watson 2 weeks ago.
Oh, good. Yes. How was he doing?
And he's fine. I was both at a brunch with him and then listened to his lecture, which was entertaining as usual. I also spoke with him on the phone at some length during the writing of the book. Unfortunately, I did not get to meet Linus Pauling, but I did, during the writing of the book, talk to many of his former students, postdocs, collaborators, and so on.
Now, you do argue that a great error by Pauling leads to the work of Watson and Crick.
Well, it doesn't quite lead to, but it's certainly the way, all the methods of the Pauling, they adopted them, you know, precisely.
Yeah.
Pauling had this idea, you know, that at the time, basically he was trying to determine structure of various molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that they tried to do that at the time was to actually shine X-rays on the molecule. And from the way that the X-rays were scattered, we call this, you know, X-ray diffraction experiments, from the way they were scattered to determine what the structure was of the molecule. Pauling kind of reversed that and said, well, you know what, first use structural chemistry, namely use everything you know on the subunits of the molecule, what their lengths are, how can you connect them, and so on and so on, and use those X-ray experiments only as a final check on what you actually get. And that's what he did, and that's how he determined the structure of proteins, which was a fantastic model of his. And that's what he tried to do in trying to determine the structure of DNA, only unsuccessfully. But Watson and Crick actually used the same method and the same way of thinking when they actually constructed the correct model.
Well, to oversimplify, Pauling's mistake was to give the DNA molecule three strands, and Watson and Crick made it a double helix rather than a triple helix.
Right. He gave it three strands. His molecule was built inside out. He had the bases on the outside instead of on the inside. And plus his model, to be honest, violated basic rules of chemistry, which was, of course, pretty astounding from a person who was the best chemist of his time.
Well, if he's the world's greatest chemist, he has the right to change the rules of chemistry, doesn't he?
Yes. The only problem was that the model he came up with violated the same rules he had in his own books.
What do you make of so great an error? How does it happen?
Well, I actually tried to go through some of the reasons that I think led to this in the book, and one of them that it was a rush job, really.
Uh-huh.
While he worked on his model for proteins for almost 13 years, trying to check for, one small discrepancy that he couldn't explain, and until he was satisfied. In the case of his model for DNA, he worked on it in earnest for about 1 month.
Uh-huh.
The second thing was he fell victim to his own previous success. In the case of the model for proteins, he had an original hunch, and then he tried to check and recheck and recheck and recheck, and at the end it turned out that his original hunch was already correct, and the rest were details. Well, when he did his model for DNA, he thought that the same will work. He knew that there were some problems with his model, but he thought, well, if I got the main structure right, then the rest are details and it will sort itself out. Well, guess what? Many times the devil is in the details.
Sure.
And his model turned out to be completely wrong.
My guest, I should remind our listeners, is Mario Livio. That's spelled L-I-V-I-O. And the title of the book that we're drawing from, and it's a wonderfully executed book, fascinating material on every page, is titled Brilliant Blunders, and subtitled From Darwin to Einstein, Colossal Mistakes by Great Scientists That Changed Our Understanding of Life and the Universe. And that is just published by Simon & Schuster. A word or two about yourself, Mario. You are Israeli by training and by origin, but born in Romania, I believe. Is that right?
Correct. I was born in Romania by I would say almost an accident of history. Lived
uh-huh.
there for 5 years, then lived in Israel, and there I grew up and got my education. But then I've been with the Hubble Space Telescope for the last 22 years.
And what do you do there in running the Hubble?
Well, I'm a theoretical astrophysicist, so I don't, build anything.
Yeah.
I don't put screws into the telescope. I deal with the science that comes from the telescope. So basically, I look at all the data that come, all the observations that come from Hubble, all those incredible images, spectra, and so on, and I construct theoretical models for them.
Now, you've done, of course, three or four prior books. The Equation That Couldn't Be Solved, Is God a Mathematician?, The Accelerating Universe, and
The Golden Ratio.
And The Golden Ratio.
Right.
What brought you to this? What's the basis for your interest in or your obsession with scientific error?
I think the main motivation was really this. I had this feeling that people sort of have developed this misconception about how science progresses.
Yes.
And,
mm-hmm.
That they think that, oh, of course Einstein had to come up with general relativity. What else could he have come up with? And, nothing can be further from the truth. Really, it is truly, this zigzag path of science, and I wanted to express that. In addition, of course, I wanted to also give some comfort to people that even the greatest luminaries can make some very serious blunders.
And the great blunder by Einstein was his cosmological constant. That requires a considerable elucidation.
Yeah, so when Einstein tried to apply his general relativity to the universe at large, he thought that the universe was completely static, that nothing moved. But he realized that, gravity, attracts everything. Every little bit attracts everything else. So in the absence of anything else, this universe would have essentially collapsed under its own weight. So what Einstein did is introduce another term which had this cosmological constant in it that was like a repulsive force that was supposed to balance gravity at every point. At every point there was the attractive force of gravity and the repulsive force of this particular term. So he first introduced this and was happy, even though this would not have achieved the job because that equilibrium was really unstable. It was like, you know, trying to balance a pencil on its tip.
One query to interrupt for a moment. Yes. This was before Hubble had advanced the science
this
of the...
Correct. This was in 1917.
So they didn't yet know that the universe was expanding.
That's right. Then when Hubble discovered that the universe is actually expanding, he said, but wait a second. If the universe is expanding, I don't need to balance everything at every point because all that gravity is going to do is going to slow down the expansion. Like, you know, I throw my keys up here on Earth, the gravity of the Earth slows them down. So he said, oh, so I don't need that term. He took it out and regretted having put it in. Now, guess what happens? In 1998, we discovered that the expansion of our universe is actually not only not slowing down, it's speeding up.
Yes.
It's accelerating.
Yes.
And do you know what propels this acceleration? What propels it appears to be precisely that term that Einstein took out.
Dark energy.
Yes. So basically, his blunder, you could argue, was taking that term out rather than putting it in. Because he actually could have predicted the acceleration of the universe.
But he had his regrets. What were they?
So he regretted having put in that term because he thought that the term was ugly, you know, unnecessary. Because if the universe was actually expanding, he didn't need this repulsive force, you know, that mm-hmm. would keep everything in balance. What he didn't realize at the time was that, you know, we have learned since then, if a theory actually allows you to do something, it's most of the time it's compulsory. So really, he should not have regretted having put it in. Had he lived till 1998 to hear about the acceleration of the universe, he probably would have regretted having taken it out.
You say in the book that if you look at his articles rather closely, in some 20% of them, he's making some mistake or other.
That is correct, but most of them are small mistakes.
Yeah.
But the greatness of Einstein is in the fact that, you know, some of these geniuses, he has such a clear picture of where he wants to get that sometimes he would make a few mathematical mistakes along the way and somehow they would cancel out and he would get the correct result at the end. Most of us cannot do that.
Would you think that all of the people that you treat in the book are essentially at the genius level?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Then
all the people I treat in the book are geniuses.
Then how does one account for genius? Or what is persistent across these various cases to mark these men as geniuses? Indeed, what is genius when it comes to physical science?
What I think it is when people manage to come up with breakthroughs that were not at some level in the air, that in, you know, had they not done that, somebody else would have done it to next week or next month or next year. They come up with an idea that is outside the box, if you like, you know, for that time.
But in the last case, the one that we haven't yet discussed, Darwin, there were a number of others who were essentially on the same track. We had a case of parallel independent invention, in a way.
You're right. I mean, in the case of Darwin, you know, these things become a little bit more complicated the farther you go back in time.
Mm-hmm.
Darwin, you know, there was no theory of genetics. There was no good theory of heredity. And the existing theory was that the characteristics of the father and the mother, they get mixed in the offspring like you would mix gin and tonic or paint or, you know, something like this. Darwin didn't know any better, so he used that theory. The blunder was in the fact that he didn't realize that with that kind of a theory, natural selection could never have worked.
Why would that have been so?
Because, you see, let's suppose that, I don't know, you have one black butterfly and a million white butterflies. And suppose that being a black butterfly confers some advantage in terms of natural mm-hmm. selection. Well, that black butterfly, according to that theory of, you know, of blending, would have been that the black butterfly would have mated with a white butterfly. They would have produced a gray butterfly, and that gray butterfly would have mated with another white butterfly, would produce a shader, a paler shade of gray for that, and that color would have been completely diluted over a few generations, and there was no way, for example, for the population to turn black as what Darwin wanted to happen.
So the new advantageous variation had no way to persist across generations.
That is exactly right. Now, what Gregor Mendel suggested when he came up with the correct theory of genetics is that really you don't blend things, you know, like paints. It's more like, you know, shuffling decks of cards.
Yeah.
You know, that if you have a jack in your hand and having a jack is a good thing, it doesn't matter how much you shuffle, you still have the jack.
And his definition of the dominant and recessive genes and so on.
That's right.
Really is the key to modern, the beginning of modern genetics.
That's right.
Curiously, he was working at roughly the same time, wasn't he?
Yeah, in fact, he published his original paper when Darwin was still alive.
Yeah.
But Darwin never got to read that. It was published in a relatively obscure journal. And one of the nice stories that I tell in the book is that there was one book in Darwin's possession which actually described a little bit Mendel's experiments. It was not by Mendel, it was by a German author, but Darwin actually never cut the pages where that description existed, so he never actually read that. And in fact, had he even read that, he would not have been illuminated much, because that person himself didn't quite understand the meaning of Mendel's experiments.
This has been a fascinating conversation, and it's based upon a very fascinating book titled Brilliant Blunders by Mario Livio. Before I let you go, and we're close to the end of the available time, I can't resist this. It's not to be found in your book particularly, but as an astrophysicist, you're about to have views on all of this, namely the question of the multiverse and the question of string theory and all that is thereby entailed. That's a new great look in cosmology. Does it excite you? Does it persuade you?
It excites me enormously. I find it hard to avoid that picture, I must say. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, we have this idea of inflation, which when the universe was a tiny fraction of a second old, it has undergone some tremendous expansion.
Yeah.
And it is very hard to avoid creating a whole ensemble of universes when such inflation occurs. So while at the moment we cannot really suggest any concrete proof to the existence of this multiverse, I find the ideas there such that we definitely have to keep an open mind to this possibility. And I think this may turn out to be true, but hopefully we will also have a better understanding of how that works and how do you calculate probabilities on this ensemble and so on.
So Fred Hoyle might have made the riposte. Well, yes, maybe the Big Bang did account for this universe, but after all, it's one of an infinity of universes.
That's right.
I could be right about all the others.
You're absolutely right. It could be that the entire ensemble is in some sort of a steady state.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My great pleasure indeed.
Songbird against the Swedish sky. Say